The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Romney's rough trip. Seeking diplomatic credibility, the White House wannabe stirs controversy in England, Israel, and Poland. So does his economic plan back home.
No matter who wins, a Wall Street veteran considers the economic and political constraints that may outweigh any partisan priorities.
Cyber insecurity, pro-business conservatives, and internet activists jointly rejoice in the death of proposed regulations, but the threat remains.
Cracking a kid porn net, how a mistakenly emailed photo led to international arrests and insights.
The home screen Olympics, raiding and raking the NBC coverage.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of August 5th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
You know, it's hard to know just how well it will turn out. There are a few things that were disconcerting, the stories about the private security firm not having enough people.
I appreciated the insights and perspectives of the leaders of the government here and opposition here, as well as the head of MI6.
It is Iran that is the leading state sponsor of terrorism and the most destabilizing nation in the world. We have a solemn duty and a moral imperative to deny Iran's leaders the means to follow through on their malevolent intentions.
A culture of entrepreneurship, greater fiscal responsibility, and international trade.
What normally would have been an overseas jaunt to demonstrate diplomatic skills and credibility on the world stage looked like something very different for Mitt Romney by the time it ended last week. In London, he raised hackles by wading into the brewing controversy over Olympic preparations and security, and even mentioning a meeting with the nation's top spy chief. In Israel, he entered the debate over Iran's nuclear program, blamed Palestinians' culture for their hardscrabble economy, not Israeli occupation, and praised Israel's healthcare system, which is even more controlled by government than Obamacare. Finally, Romney praised the free market spirit of post-Soviet Poland, failing to note that country's government-funded healthcare, government-funded higher education, and allowances for newborns.
Back home, the soon-to-be GOP nominee faced new polling by Quinnipiac University, CBS, and the New York Times that showed an edge for Barack Obama in the battleground states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, where the president's TV spots have focused on Romney's background in private equity investment and his refusal to release more than his most current taxes. And a new Pew poll gave the president a 10-point lead, although questions were raised about an oversampling of Democrats. To consider these and other political developments of the week for your ears only, we're joined again by Republican public affairs consultant and political historian Craig Shirley. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much.
What's your bottom line on Romney's foreign trip? And did he help himself with his party base, if not some overseas audiences and foreign policy mavens?
I don't think the base was paying attention, quite frankly, to the overseas trip. I mean, it is summer, number one. And number two is that is not where most Americans' attention or concerns are. Our attentions right now are fairly diffused, and to the point that to the extent that most Americans think about foreign policy, it tends to be a little bit isolationist, much as it was after World War One, but now after Afghanistan and Iraq, is that people are, in this country are tending to look inward instead of outward.
Does his view on culture as making all the difference in national destiny make it difficult to see him as president dealing with many of the world's poorest and problematic populations?
For some reason, Romney, David, is just having a difficult kind of time connecting with the American people. You know, we've all seen the columns and the commentators talking about this being the most content-free campaign that they can remember. And I think for once, a lot of the columnists are right, is that candidates don't seem to be talking about issues very much, and certainly not issues that are uppermost in the minds of most Americans right now.
And that view of culture, does that also send a message to some key voting groups here back home, Latinos, African Americans?
I don't know if it goes that deep. These foreign policy, you know, if they had asked my advice, I would say don't do it, because that's not where Americans' mindset is. It's not in Europe, it's not in Israel, it's not in Poland. It is on the Olympics, but to the extent it's on the Olympics, it's on the athletes, and I don't see any of their successes, you know, accruing to Romney's benefit. The last time I can remember where a presidential team decided one of the running mates should go on a foreign policy trip was in 1980, after George Bush was selected by Reagan at the convention in Detroit, and to buttress the foreign policy experience, because Bush had been ambassador or the representative to mainland China, he was sent to China in the Far East on a diplomatic mission, or you know, to showcase their foreign policy credentials, and it ended up being a disaster because he got caught, in the whole debate over the two-China policy, over whether or not the United States should recognize both mainland China and Taiwan. So you have to go back 30 years ago, and that was really pretty much of a disaster for the Reagan-Bush team. I don't think Romney gained anything. He probably lost a little bit on his foreign policy venture.
What do you make of the Pew poll and their explanation of the Democratic oversample?
Look, you know, if you go back to 1900, we've had 20-some-odd elections, and really in 1932 and 1980 was there a straight-up choice for the American people. Do you stay with the status quo of the incumbent, or do you choose the change of the challenger? And, of course, in 1932, they chose the change of FDR, and in 1980, they chose the change of Reagan. The other campaigns, such as 1912, 1976, and 1980, were somewhat anomalous, as in Ford was not an incumbent. I mean, not 1980, but 1992. You had Ross Perot on the ticket. So the bottom line is Americans do not like to throw incumbent presidents out of office unless they have a really good reason why. And I'm not sure there's a really good reason why right now.
What about the time CBS Quinnipiac surveys in battleground states where Democrats have focused so much TV time on Romney's Bain Capital experience and his taxes? Is that going to be a key to the election?
Yeah, it's going to be a key to the election, and in a lot of these, some of these battleground states is that the economy is doing better than the national economy. In Virginia, unemployment is just over 5%. Unemployment in Ohio is a full percentage point below where it was when Obama took office. So that is going to have for President Obama, that's going to be a lot of wind at his sails that it's going to be difficult for Romney to capture.
As a political veteran, what's your view of how business experience, even apart from so-called vulture capitalism, benefits the president of a country whose neediest areas and people can't be outsourced or sold off?
Well, the business experience is fine. Although Calvin Coolidge never said the business of American is business, is that everybody understands the model of free market economics and entrepreneurship and how all these things churn jobs and growth in the economy. But I think the problem with Romney is that he wasn't necessarily creating a job so much as he was creating wealth, and he has yet to make the psychic connection with the American voter that his experience can directly benefit. That's what these things are about, is that who is the candidate who's best going to make that psychic connection with most voters and convince them that they're going to help them in the future, and they're going to help the country in the future, and they're going to help their children in the future.
Do you think that success of Tea Party congressional candidates, as in Texas last week, will help build momentum for Romney or siphon it away, focusing conservatives more on races below the presidential contest?
I think you can argue it both ways, is that there's still a lot of divisions inside the Republican Party that have yet to be healed up in advance of Tampa Bay. Romney, in many ways, won the nomination not by advancing his own ideas, but by running a campaign to undermine his opponents. And there's still a lot of conservatives, a lot of Tea Party devotees who remain unconvinced of Romney's sincerity about his conservative credentials. And it might well be that they focus their attention on the down ticket races and not on the presidential. If they're asking my advice, I would say, you got to practice trickle down politics, and you should focus on the presidential campaign with the idea that would accrue to the benefit of the down ticket races.
Republican public affairs consultant and Reagan biographer Craig Shirley. His latest book is December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World.
Quote from the news, we're not going to be able to make a lot of decisions that need to be made until the American people decide who the decision makers are going to be. That was Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma on the House and Senate taking their August recess without acting on a Democratic farm bill, a more limited GOP drought bill, and a controversial cybersecurity act.
Next, no matter who wins, post-election constraints for your ears only.
We'll be right back.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. He raised expectations which he could not fulfill. That was Jörg Kramer, chief economist at Commerzbank in Frankfurt, on the fury triggered by European Central Bank President Mario Draghi, who had promised, quote, whatever it takes to stabilize the eurozone, but last week held off on an actual plan, pending more political and economic steps by European leaders. Now this.
We get our economists, we go through and say, okay, how many jobs will be created just by doing those things? And I got more coming down the road, but just those things alone create 12 million new American jobs. 12 million jobs.
We know better than this. They have been trying to sell us this trickle-down tax cut fairy dust before.
In fact, the plans to which Mitt Romney referred were too vague and incomplete to permit the most rigorous analysis, but a bipartisan panel of experts projected that it would require more middle-class hardship to balance tax cuts for the highest earners. And Barack Obama had to confront another tick back up in the unemployment rate last week to 8.3%, despite the addition of a better-than-expected 163,000 jobs in July.
For all the partisan differences in their policies and priorities, though, how different would their presidencies be? Not very, says veteran financial expert Ken Lipper, former New York deputy mayor for finance and development. And with more post-election predictions for your ears only, Ken Lipper joins us again now. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
You say either man's administration will be affected less by priorities than by the pipeline, and you don't mean from Canada. Explain.
I think that in some elections, people have a tremendous pipeline going in. For example, Clinton left a balanced budget and, in fact, some surpluses. So another administration having that would have the same benefits that Bush had of a relatively intact financial situation, which allows you to take more initiatives and to use that money constructively. In our case, in that case, we went into two wars. This administration, whomever it will be, whether it'll be President Romney or President Obama, you're going to have a situation of totally constrained budgets, where the budget itself, rather than having any possible surplus, is itself the problem. The budget is totally out of whack. We're building up multi-trillion dollar deficits, which currently are sustainable because the rest of the world is in worse shape and people are rushing money into the United States. But we know, just as it happened in Greece and just as it happened in New York City during the fiscal crisis, these things happen suddenly. The debt levels become unsustainable. The world markets lose confidence. First, interest rates go up, and then they turn the tap off and nothing flows at all.
You also say the underlying theme of the next 4 years worldwide will be deleveraging. What does that mean, and how will it affect what any president can do?
Deleveraging means that the world, not just the United States, not just the consumer in the United States, but the consumer throughout the world and governments throughout the world have basically financed either consumption in the consumer's case, or another form of consumption is that the governments around the world have been providing benefits to their populations, which they could only sustain with borrowings. And the people in these countries have naturally gotten used to levels of benefit which cannot be sustained without outside infusions. And now the financial markets have rejected the idea of continuing this level of support, and you get a tremendous amount of civil unrest in these countries as the governments have to lay off people, cut the equivalent of Social Security, cut any other benefits that are going to the public. So you get this, whether it's in Egypt or in Greece or anywhere else, you're getting this shrinking of the debt burden or potential increase in the debt burden through reduction of services and benefits.
Globally, you see drought, food and water shortages, civil disorder as major factors.
With the deleveraging that's taking place, there's a shrinking in the economy, there's a shrinking in the government sectors, and more people are forced to cut their standard of living. And indeed, in these poor countries, many of them are being pushed out of the cities where they've concentrated in recent years and back into the rural villages. And one has to ask himself, are these people going to go peacefully? Will somebody who's lived in Bombay or in Shanghai or any other place, relatively comfortable, if not in a wealthy circumstance, suddenly go back to subsistence planting in a remote village without expressing his dissatisfaction?
The good news for the United States is that you see circumstances shaping up for a grand compromise on both spending and tax reforms. What are the key signs of that?
Well, I think you just subsequent to my giving a public address on that, I noticed that Senator Graham, who's a Republican, suddenly acknowledged that he would be open to compromise on tax reform or tax increases. I think that many people who are kind of trapped in the ideological wars in the Congress will assert themselves, as Senator Graham did, and he is a leading senator in the Republican Party, but many people who are unwilling to hide their heads in the rhetorical sands of saying no new taxes or no cuts to benefits, I think that there is a rational group of people who are trapped in this extensive election year bipartisanship and are beginning to assert themselves to recognize that this is a fundamental national problem, that the budget cannot go on, that they're going to collapse the economy if they don't do something about it. Many of them have huge interests at stake. For example, if nothing is done to balance the budget by the end of the year, or to cut the spending and in one way or another by the end of this year, one is they got to get permission from a joint session of Congress. They're going to have to get permission to increase the debt ceiling. We know how that worked last time. The whole government practically shut down, and it'll be worse this time. Second of all, to get around that issue last time, they put into effect what they call sequestration, where there would automatically be $1 trillion of cuts in programs if the budget isn't brought into line. All kinds of serious consequences will come to the defense budget and many other budgets, whether it's environmental protection or education. So everyone in Congress sees something to lose practically except extremists by having this automatic sequestration come into effect. The only way to avoid that will be to take a positive action on reforming the budget and getting the revenues and expenses to come into a match.
Veteran financial expert Ken Lipper is a former New York deputy mayor for finance and development and an Oscar-winning filmmaker. His investment and advisory firm is Lipper & Company in New York.
Quote from the news, the machines have taken over, right? That was Patrick Healy, chief executive of the Issuer Advisory Group consulting firm, on the wild Wall Street dive caused by an automated stock trading program at the Knight Capital Brokerage. A rogue algorithm suddenly flooded the market with bogus trades, leaving Knight with a crippling $440 million debt and raising new doubts that regulators can keep up with the electronic programs that market now relies on.
Next, protectors of big business and internet activists cheer the sidelining of a proposed cybersecurity law. For your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Messages confusing what is right with what is safe. That was AIDS activist Canon Gideon Byamugisha on a recent resurgence of the disease in Uganda. Once an example of great success against AIDS, Uganda is now one of only two countries in Africa where the rate is rising despite massive help from the U.S. PEPFAR program. Labeling extramarital affairs and homosexuality as unacceptable apparently has just driven them underground. Now this.
It creates uncertainty in place of trust. It erodes statutory and constitutional civil rights protections. And it creates a surveillance regime in place of a targeted, nimble cybersecurity program that is needed to truly protect our nation.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden was an outspoken opponent of proposed internet security legislation back in June and one of the Democrats to vote against the cybersecurity bill that came up last week, also opposed by a rare blend of business-oriented conservatives and high-tech activists.
No one doubts the need to protect the networks on which so much of the nation's operations and communications now depend. Consider what would happen if transit, power, or banking systems were infected by the kind of virus that has plagued Iran's nuclear program. Or just look at what happened when a new stock trading program accidentally caused a wild dive on Wall Street just days ago. On the other hand are privacy rights and concerns about new government-imposed constraints on business. To talk about all these concerns and how they might be a little bit better balanced for your ears only, we're joined by Ryan Radia, Associate Director of Technology Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington. Welcome to our program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We should straight away say that the cybersecurity bill left languishing in Congress last week did not even get a straight up or down vote, but was blocked by disagreement on extraneous amendments. Can you explain that?
No one could come to an agreement on which amendments would be allowed. There was no 60 senators who were able to support it. The Republicans wanted a number of amendments, including an amendment to repeal Obamacare, which naturally is something Democrats do not want to vote on. Part of the disagreement was also substantive. The core provisions of the bill that they deal with, first, cybersecurity standards, and second, information sharing. The business community has long been critical of the approach supported by Democrats and the president to create new regulations, new standards for what are called critical infrastructure entities. While the bill in the Senate was watered down late in the process to make the standards, quote, voluntary, there was a great deal of disagreement about whether they were, in fact, truly voluntary. The argument that the business community made was, first, that it has a strong incentive to keep its infrastructure secure, whether it's a telecom company or a search company, or a defense contractor. The last thing that a company wants is for its property to be the target of a cyber attack. Second, the companies argue, correctly in my view, that while cybersecurity is a real threat, the Department of Homeland Security or some new government bureaucracy isn't likely to have any better idea how to keep networks secure than industry. If a company's standards aren't good enough, then it might lose customers to a competing firm who has more effective cybersecurity practices.
Talk more about CEI's concern that the bill, even as modified, could lead internet companies to break their contracts with clients, users.
That was one of our big concerns with the bill. The immunity provision that Senator Wyden discussed in the earlier clip was remarkably broad. This is a different part of the bill. It's the information sharing provisions, which are designed to let companies share cybersecurity threat information with other companies or with government. And if they do so, or if they believe that they're doing so, sharing cyber threat information, they are immune. They cannot be sued for anything whatsoever. Our criticism is that this is the wrong approach to building trust in what's called cloud computing. People are storing their emails on Gmail. We're backing up our machines on Dropbox. We're using all sorts of companies' services on the cloud to put our papers and effects. Our data that we once stored at home in a file cabinet or in our desk is now being put on the cloud. That's a great evolution. It's efficient. It's letting us access information from more places. And in many respects, it's actually safer to put your information in the cloud. But this immunity provision that lets every company share what's called cyber threat information with other companies, with the government, with pretty much anyone, without being liable for the contracts, is a direct assault on the sanctity of these terms. We think companies should be able to compete with respect to privacy. One company can say, we will share this information if we think it contains a cyber threat. One company can say we won't, or a company could even say we will share it, but we'll give you a notice first and an opportunity to, say, anonymize the data.
An article you wrote last week said network owners should have the right to block any content they don't want to carry. Can't that lead to widespread and unpredictable censorship based on management's religious, moral, or political beliefs, like discussions of birth control, abortion, or gay marriage, the way certain subjects and websites are blocked in China?
Censorship is a huge threat, but the real risk of censorship comes from government. That's what we've seen in China. It's a top-down approach where the government is not letting private networks or networks that are purportedly private pick what they want to carry. Here in the United States, our view is that a network owner should have the right to block content, assuming it hasn't promised not to. But that doesn't mean that we think that all network owners should exercise that right. We have a lot of rights we don't exercise. People can patronize companies based on what they do and do not block. So there could be a network that is family-friendly, that blocks indecent content. And if some people want to get internet from that company, that should be their right. Frankly, I think it's highly unlikely that the vast majority of Americans are going to want to subscribe to a network that blocks politically unpopular content simply because, first, network, it's very unwieldy to try to block speech. It's complicated. It's costly. It's not a thing to do that is easy. Second, if a network can block speech that you don't like, it can block speech that you do like.
Ryan Radia is Associate Director of Technology Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington.
Quote from the news, "There is not one human problem that could not be solved if people would simply do as I advise." That was celebrity social critic, author, and activist Gore Vidal, at least as famous for acerbic sparring with the likes of William Buckley and Norman Mailer, than for his 25 novels, 2 memoirs, various plays, and screenplays. He died from complications of pneumonia at age 86.
Next, penetrating a child porn ring. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberg.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It's still possible to get your fried chicken sandwich fix and keep your moral principles intact. That was Sarah Laskow writing on the website Grist about various versions of the dish being prepared as part of a protest against the Chick-fil-A chain, whose chief has devoted millions of dollars to his Bible-based opposition to gay marriage. Supporters of his position or his product, including former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, jammed stores around the country last week in a Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. Now this.
A ring of men who produced and shared thousands of abusive photographs and videos of young children over the internet. 33 people have been arrested worldwide, 138 children have been saved from further abuse, and many more children in the Netherlands, the rest of Europe, and the United States have been spared a similar fate.
It's among the most disturbing of crimes, the abuse of young children for photographs traded across the internet by child pornographers, some of whom could be your next-door neighbor. The particular ring of pornographers whose discovery and dismantling was described last May by John Morton, director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, spanned the U.S. and Europe, and is just the tip of the iceberg.
With technology growing ever more sophisticated, so are the networks disseminating child porn, and it's exploding across countries, continents, and cultures. Most of the children are prepubescent, one in this case only 18 months old. It's hard to imagine the mindset of those involved, much less to learn about and target their dark operations. Reporter Jennifer McKim, a Pulitzer Prize nominee, explored the case Morton described for a story in last Sunday's Boston Globe, and she joins us now for Your Ears Only. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
First, tell us about yourself and how a real estate reporter for the Globe came to investigate and write about a case like this.
Well, I've been a reporter for 20 years, and I've covered a lot of beats. Before I was hired at the Globe, I was covered children and family issues at another paper. And basically, as part of my beat, I receive a lot of press releases, and I was reading over and over press releases from the U.S. Attorney's Office saying sentencing and charging and convicting of men for pornography. And I thought, you know, this is a story that we sort of read briefly, but we don't really know a whole lot about. And so I went to my editor and said this was a story I wanted to write. I originally thought it was going to be a business story, thinking that this was, you know, how do people make money off victimizing children? But it turned out that it's really more a cashless type of industry where people are trading these awful photos like baseball cards across the internet.
Although the porn ring in this case was international in scope, there was a local angle at the start. Talk about the little boy whose picture first came to the attention of law enforcement.
Okay, so this story all started by federal agents from the Homeland Security Investigations in Boston. They're part of ICE, Customs and Immigration, the federal agency. And basically, they were monitoring a site of child pornography when they got an email from a man who lived in Milford, Massachusetts, which is about 40 minutes from Boston, who thought that he was talking to other people like himself, like-minded people who look at child pornography. And instead, he sent it to the federal investigators. What he sent them was a picture of an 18-month-old boy that the men looked at, and they just, you know, they see these pictures all the time because that's their job. And yet this boy was so young, and the picture appeared to be so new through its the quality of the picture that they really wanted to find this boy. So they started to send it around all over Europe, and they sent it to an international database, and somebody tracked it down that way. But it all started with this one little photo.
Was that an accident, or had they put an email address out there as a kind of a lure to try to make people think that they were part of the gang?
Well, it's part of an undercover type of operation. A lot of these federal investigators do actually interact on these websites and talk to people on them. So somebody was posing as somebody like them. So, yeah, the guy in Milford did not plan to send that to him, but he thought he was sending it to someone like him.
Let's talk a bit about the perpetrators. Tell us about Robert DeDuca, the man who sent that photo and was discovered to have a collection of sadistic pictures, including the rape of children. What's his background?
The thing about it is he was a man in his 40s. He was married for more than 25 years. He had bringing up his own children in college and high school. He lived in a nice street in a residential area. He worked at a hotel. He had, you know, no criminal history. The thing that is probably the most scary is generally that is sort of what people like this are. They're not people who stand out to you as completely sort of creepy or problematic. And it's sort of this thing that advocates say, you know, you should not be worried about the stranger danger. You should be worried about the people around you. And this was a case of a man who, when he was not, you know, with his family or working in as a hotel manager, he was sitting at his computer looking at thousands and thousands of photos. Basically, they collect them, like, as I said, like baseball cards, series of photos of different kids. They know what they call them, things like the boy series was a cookie series. They called it the cookie series, and they wanted all of the pictures that somebody had taken of them. So that's sort of what these people are doing right now.
DeDuca didn't actually physically abuse children himself, although he egged others on, but a man in the Netherlands did. Talk about what led investigators overseas to Robert Mikkelsen, the man dubbed the Monster of Riga.
DeDuca sent the picture. The federal investigators looked at it and said it was a little picture of a little boy holding a bunny, and he was naked from the bottom down, and they looked at it and just thought, you know, we want to find this kid, and this is the problem. This is this whole new sort of law enforcement where people are trying to track down these kids. They're like, every single picture of child pornography is a crime scene, and they look into these pictures to find out any type of clue to basically put these children on planet Earth because they have no idea. And they send it first to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, where they have a database of thousands of these pictures, and some of them are already identified, just so that if a law enforcement person finds it, they're not trying to track down the same kid over and over again. So he was not recognized there. They sent it all over Europe, and they sent it to Interpol. A woman who does the same work as these men in Boston but works for the Netherlands, for the Dutch police, saw this picture, and she saw this little bunny. She recognized it as a Dutch character of a children's book that all the Dutch kids like, and she thought, oh boy, this little boy might be Dutch. So she did some more investigation, found out that his little orange shirt that he had on was made in a little handmade shop in the Netherlands, and decided, we need to find this little boy because I think he's in this country. And so they did something. They put a picture, a sanitized picture of him on something like America's Most Wanted on the national television in the Netherlands. And within hours, the family of this little boy recognized that boy and called the police.
Jennifer McKim is a reporter for the Boston Globe.
Quote from the news, "It's like a day of reckoning coming nearer." That was Rajiv Kumar, Secretary General of the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry, on blackouts that left 670 million people without power, approximately 10% of the world's population, including riders stalled on trains and miners trapped underground. The blame fell on an overtaxed and undermanaged government electric system.
Next, the newest Olympic event, whining about NBC's coverage. For your ears only.
The final race for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Clear indications that an attack was being planned. That was Spain's Interior Minister Jorge Fernandez Diaz on three men arrested on suspicion of links to al-Qaeda and plans to target somewhere in Europe. Now this.
I kind of forgot about that. Man, that's awesome. To be the first, you know, African-American to win the Olympics. Yeah, that's definitely an amazing feeling. I forgot about that.
Unacceptable. I mean, I know the Badminton Federation really well. They will take that really seriously. It is unacceptable.
Week one of the London Olympics had a predictable share of highs and lows, with smiling 16-year-old Gabby Douglas dubbed the Flying Squirrel winning hearts worldwide, along with the women's gymnastic all-around title, and eight better-than-good badminton players throwing their matches and catching hell from angry fans, including Sebastian Coe, chairman of the London Organizing Committee. There were also multi-gold records for American water babies, most notably Missy Franklin and Michael Phelps, and, on the other hand, far fewer free-spending tourists than expected in London, and endless internet abuse for the way NBC was covering all the games of 2012.
J.R. Lind covers sports and the business of sports for the Nashville Post and the NashvilleScene.com. His word for the whiners is, suck it up. And to talk more about his criticism of the criticism about the evolution of Olympic coverage and about the games themselves, for your ears only, we're pleased to have J.R. Lind on the line now. Welcome to our program.
Thanks.
Given all the hours of live coverage on several NBC-owned cable channels and websites, what's the complaint about the taped coverage package for primetime?
Well, I think the big complaint is now in 2012 with so much information available, not just from NBC products, but from news products around the world. The surprise of the events is ruined when NBC shows those premier events, gymnastics, swimming, this week it'll be track, tape delayed. People are saying, why would I watch when I already know the outcome? But the fact is they are watching. NBC has record ratings pretty much every night this week.
You say it's a case of old media trying to please both old and new audiences.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of that. Most of the money in this country is still with the baby boom generation who grew up with tape-delayed Olympics. Even as recently as 16 years ago, Atlanta was tape-delayed, and that was in Eastern time zone, obviously. So now you have people in their 20s and 30s that are spending money, making money, and they feel like maybe NBC isn't catering to them by sticking with this tape-delay model.
And how are the primetime replays doing in the ratings game?
Killing the ratings. In 2008, famously, China changed the schedule in Beijing to have live events in prime time in America. And even without the surprise that we had in China, with people knowing the outcome, NBC is having record ratings. They actually announced this week they expect to make money on the Olympics, which going in, nobody expected. The Olympics were sort of a loss leader for NBC so they can set up for the fall season. But, you know, NBC Sports is now saying we will make a profit. They issued another round of ad buys at a higher level.
What was your personal rating of the extraordinary and endless opening ceremonies?
I loved the opening ceremonies. I thought Danny Boyle did a great job capturing sort of a British sense of humor and a British sense of history. He got the Queen involved, showed off her sort of famously dry, secret sense of humor. NBC's coverage, I didn't think was great, but the ceremony I thought was fantastic.
Since that first night, this has become the spoiler Olympics, with NBC undermining its own alerts in at least one key case.
Yeah, Missy Franklin, who the American swimmer, 17 years old, sort of one of the early darlings of these Olympics, her first gold medal, they had built up this great drama with tape delay, which is one of the advantages of tape delay. NBC can drive the narrative. She had swum a semifinal, was getting ready for a final for her first gold medal. They cut to commercial. The promo was an advertisement for the next morning's Today show. We'll speak to gold medal winner Missy Franklin with her gold medal around her neck. So, and then they came back, of course, and Missy Franklin tries for gold. Well, you just ruined it, even for the people who had taken pains to avoid knowing the results all day long.
Of course, some niche sports can't even hope for spoiler snafus because they won't make prime time. But you find them benefiting from all the new eyes online.
One of the big winners among the niche sports for the first weekend was archery. Archery benefits, I think, also from Hunger Games, which are wildly popular books and movies that have an archery element. Also, it helped that archery was really the only sport that was handing out medals on the first day. So NBC showing a lot of archery on that first weekend on TV sort of bled in online. Archery is very easy to understand. The strategy is very simple. The scoring isn't complicated like some things like fencing, for example, which is sort of hard to jump into. Archery is very easy. Thought that sport got a big boost. Also, team handball, a sport that America really should be good at. It's running, it's jumping, it's throwing, it's very fast-paced, it's very easy to grasp. A lot of people talking about team handball in week one.
Whether badminton qualifies as a niche sport is arguable, since more of us play that sport than work out on the balance beam or the pommel horse. But what people saw of it in the game's first days was decidedly disappointing. Explain the strategy of winning by losing that the 8 disqualified players had adopted.
Yeah, badminton, like many of these sports in the Olympics, uses a pool system. You play a series of matches to set up sort of the playoff for the medals. Chinese, Singapore, they had seen how the brackets were laying out. It was to their benefit to lose their final match to get a lower seed and play maybe an easier team or put another favorite team on the opposite side of the bracket. And they were obviously, in that last match of the pool round, trying to lose, hitting serves into the net to the point that the crowd was booing during the event. They were apologized to by the Olympic Organizing Committee, and the Badminton Federation sent those 8 badminton players home.
On a positive note, what was your favorite Olympic moment on the screen in this first week?
I would have to say, too, I think Missy Franklin's first gold medal, which, you know, in hindsight has set up the emergence of this great star, 17. She'll be on the scene for a long time. And really, that whole series of things that happened with gymnastics early on, Jordan Weaver, world champion, did not qualify for the Olympic all-around. So there was sort of this tears from her while Ali Reisman was celebrating. Then the next day, Weber was the last to go, sort of secured the U.S. gold medal in the women's team competition. And then, of course, Gabby Douglas winning the gold medal in the women's all-around. Just smiles everywhere. She and Missy Franklin, I think, are the stars of week one.
J.R. Lind covers sports and the business of sports for the Nashville Post and NashvilleScene.com.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and feedburner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to davidearsonly at gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Rachel Murray and Amy Snopek. I'm Melissa Axelberg.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Amy Snopek. This week last year, we considered the situation in Iran, threatening and feeling threatened at the same time, from our August 7th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Catherine Herzog.
Opponents and supporters of Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak clashed last week outside the Cairo courtroom where Mubarak lay on a hospital gurney in the prisoner's cage as his trial began on charges in connection with corruption and the killing of democracy demonstrators whose protests led to his ouster. Meanwhile, opponents of Syria's president Bashar al-Assad took to the streets again in Damascus and other major cities and were cut down by government gunfire in Hama. And disillusion was reportedly spreading in Tunisia, birthplace of what had been called the Middle East Democracy Spring.
All of which is being closely followed by the leaders of Iran, for whom Syria is among its last supporters in the region, and whose great fear is that unrest across the Mideast will reignite popular opposition within Iran's borders. At the same time, U.S. officials say Iran continues to aid and abet anti-Western violence in Afghanistan and Iraq as U.S. forces proceed with scheduled drawdowns. To talk more about Iran, both threatened and threatening, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
How is the bloody protest and pushback in Syria affecting its role as Iran's sole ally in the region?
I think it is making the Iranian leaders very, very nervous. That's why every indication is that they have sent aid in form of Revolutionary Guard commanders, in form of cash, in form of advice, in form of reassurance to make sure that Assad stays and does not go. They have also tried to pressure Turkey to take more neutral role.
How does the unrest throughout the region and the image of an aged, ailing Mubarak on trial in Egypt affect the way Iran's leaders deal with dissent in their own country?
Well, they have a very Soviet-style, era-like reading of history. They pick and choose their facts and ignore what is uncomfortable. They, for example, attack the democratic movement in Syria as something that is created by Israel and the United States. In Egypt, if you read the news from Iran, you would think that the entire Egyptian democratic movement wants nothing but the creation of Islamic State there. So their reading is that this is an Islamic movement in Egypt, and it is an Israeli movement in Syria. And in Bahrain, for example, it is the Shiites who are rebelling against the government. They like that movement, but they don't like what is happening in, for example, Libya. They're concerned that the fall of Syria and Libya will eventually expedite their own fall.
You've written that increasing contention in Iran over Islamic dress code for women may prove a key element in the history of clerical power's rise and eventual fall there. What's happening on that front?
Well, every summer, when the heat gets increased in Tehran, attacks on women also increase. This year, what has been remarkable is that before the beginning of summer, there have been a number of rapes reported, a few gang rapes reported, and the fact that the regime, instead of coming down hard on the rapists, has essentially more than once accused the woman for being raped, accused them of having loose dress and loose demeanor, has antagonized the woman even more. So there is an ongoing battle between the woman and the regime for their ability to dress as they like. The last week, one of the most remarkable things happened in Iran. It's been very little reported in the West, but it's really shaken the regime to the core. People organize on the Facebook that on a certain hour in the day, they would converge in a park and bring guns filled with water and play water games with one another. This water game has now become a major point of contention for the regime. They think Israel and the United States have helped organize this water game movement. But the only simple fact is young men and women playing with water in summer heat in Tehran is the most natural thing one can expect.
Talk about the way Iran's clerical and military leaders also been putting pressure on the country's provocative president, Ahmad Ahmadinejad, to fix him, and why.
Well, Ahmadinejad, by every indication, had begun to begin his own myth that he was, in fact, elected. As you know, there was a contested election in 2009. Every indication is that he lost that election, but it was an electoral coup d'etat by the IRGC. But Ahmadinejad began to act as if he, in fact, did have 24 million votes. He began to defy Khamenei's orders and wishes. He began to fire Khamenei aides and ministers close to Khamenei, and Khamenei decided to teach him a lesson in the hard realities of who really controls the media and who controls the IRGC. And within days, the man who was praised as the most pious president in the history of the Islamic Republic was now being lambasted as a devil worshiper, as someone who conjured Satan, someone who killed cats in mysterious Masonic rites to work and talk with the devil, all kinds of rather strange accusations, and they came very, very close to impeaching him. There are articles of impeachment still at the Majlis pending, standing over his head like the famous sword in case he misbehaves.
We should remind the listeners that Ayatollah Khamenei is the supreme leader, the clerical top dog. But you say that he and other clerical rulers also may feel some pressure from the military, notably the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards.
My sense is that the IRGC is now the top dog, as you would call it, in Iran. I think they control at least 40% to 50% of the economy. The man who was in charge of their biggest construction company, an IRGC company called Qarargah Khatam al-Anbiya, is now the Minister of Oil. So the oil, which is 80% of the government's income, some say 90%, is now directly controlled by the IRGC. So 40 to 50% of the entire economy is then in their hands. Oil is in their hand. They're the only force that is keeping the democratic movement at bay. Khamenei, the leader, is increasingly isolated even amongst the clergy. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out the real force in Iran that is keeping the regime afloat is the IRGC, and they are increasingly becoming more assertive and demanding more and more of political rights, which had traditionally been denied to them.
Dr. Abbas Milani is director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there.
Iran, threatening and threatened. From our August 7th, 2011 broadcast. Last week, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps commander said escalating economic sanctions and military threats had reached a very sensitive and fateful stage. And Ayatollah Ahmad Jannati, secretary of the powerful Guardian Council, conceded that Iran was caught on an economic crisis. But both men predicted resistance to cyber attacks and other soft war tactics. Meanwhile, a former Israeli intelligence chief warned against an outright military strike that would cost Israel the international legitimacy it would need for continuing action against Iran's nuclear program. I'm Amy Snopek. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, a song by Hollywood crooner Tony Martin, dead last week at age 98.
Chance that you can. won't you answer the fervent prayer of a stranger in paradise? Don't send me in dark despair from all that I hunger for, but open your angel eyes.